now I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
My sobriety date is May 5th, 1987, and I owe all that to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. I have a home group, and I still believe Alcoholics Anonymous works after all these years, believe it or not. And hopefully I'll get into some of that. I started drinking at age 13, and it was Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. Believe it or not. All right. I know what I like to say now, that if the Boone's Farm Company still exists, because I haven't looked in the liquor cabinets or in the coolers in the stores in quite a number of years, my mind just hasn't gone there. They should have on the inside, as you're drinking it down, warning: if you are 13 years old and you drink a whole bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill, you may be a future member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I graduated to screwdrivers. That's, if you don't know what those are, that's orange juice and vodka. And if you get sick on a screwdriver, you will never drink one again, because the vodka will make you sick. And I never drank one again once I got sick and drank the whole bottle of the screwdriver. I graduated to Mad Dog 2020. If you've ever tried that, I believe it has something in common with Boone's Farm. It's never seen a grape. I think both those wines are synthetic. Didn't matter to me. It just mattered if I could get drunk off of it. Well, I drank the whole bottle of the Mad Dog 2020. I got sick. I threw up. And guess what? I never drank another whole bottle of Mad Dog 2020. I graduated then to Michelob Ponies with non-habit-forming marijuana. I was trying to adjust my highs and my drunkenness by then, and that went for a while, and then I went into Budweiser Tall Necks, and I drank those for a while. And then I ended up with what put me in Alcoholics Anonymous was Heineken. I loved everything about Heineken. I loved the bottle. I loved the label. I loved where it was made. Amsterdam, what an exciting place. If you don't know about Amsterdam, it is a very exciting place, especially for people like me. There's excitement in the air, you know. And just loved everything about it except for two things: when the bottle was empty and when I got in trouble with it, you know. And but I did love my Heineken. Heineken beer did such a great job on me, it put me smack dab right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. did a good job for me. But I had some run-ins with the law. I got arrested 11 times, I thought, and this is my perception. Lately, I was looking at my background checks. I was just interested in what was still on them, because I had a lot of stuff on my background checks, and I actually paid the state police to run one for me, and two were left, and one I didn't even know about. I never knew I was a fugitive. Virginia Beach still had me down as a fugitive. I couldn't remember being arrested for that. But that was interesting to see that I had not been arrested 11 times, I had been arrested 12 times. And every time I got drunk or put something else in my body, I didn't get in trouble. But every time I was in trouble, I had something in my body. And when I got sober, I have not been arrested since. Okay, so it goes together. I just could not help but get arrested. In fact, in the DUI, one of my DUI courts, actually there was two significant happenings that I remember that I think really summed up my drinking more than not. Is in 1982, I got stopped in Washington, D.C., going down a one-way street at 4 a.m. in the morning, and they had given me a drunk driving charge, and they sent me to the court, and the young counselor asked me a question. And the question was, Mr. Jacobson, your blood alcohol, whatever it may have been at that time, was very high, and this was a Wednesday night, middle of the week. And she said, were you drinking for any special occasion? Right, exactly. And she said, was there a birthday involved, a wedding, a funeral, a bachelor party? I mean, I would have loved to have said yes, but unfortunately there wasn't anything there that was I was celebrating, because she didn't know and I didn't know at that time that the only reason for an alcoholic to drink is really no reason at all. And I didn't know that till I got here, and you guys taught me that kind of stuff. And then the next lady in another drunk driving charge that I had asked me another question that stuck with me up to this date. She said, and this time the lawyer had suggested that I go to a whole bunch of AA meetings before I see the judge, and if I could show them that I was an AA, he may let me off the hook. You can't do that nowadays, but back then you could do a lot of stuff to get off the hook on the DUI charge. And so I went to a bunch of AA meetings, and I came in. I had to speak to her before I went into the court. And she said, you've been to a lot of AA meetings, I can see. I said, yes, ma'am. She said, do you believe that you are an alcoholic? I said, no, ma'am. She said, why did you go to all those AA meetings? I said, because it was asked by my lawyer. She said, do you have a sobriety date? And I said, yes, ma'am. I said, it's June 15th, whatever year that was. And she said, that's very interesting. She said, you know that people that are non-alcoholics don't have sobriety dates? Because it's not important when they quit drinking. I mean, I got caught twice by these people, and I really thought I was smarter than everybody. But they caught me in these tricky questions. And what happened to me, and it holds true today. And remember one thing, is there is no letter of the law in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we first get here, we really believe there's the letter of the law, and this is the way that you do it. But my grand sponsor kind of cuts to the chase on that. He says, the only problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is full of alcoholics. There's a lot of truth to that. Okay, and there's a lot of different ways of looking at things, and this is just one way that I have come to look at it. And I thought, because I ended up going to some of our friends in the psychological department, I thought that I suffered from an emotional illness, because it looked like it had psychological symptoms to it. In fact, it felt from time to time as though I may have had a mental illness. In between my drinking and all the other stuff I was putting into me, of course it looked that way. And I didn't know till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that the mental illness looks just like the spiritual illness. That on the outside of AA, when you're not in AA, it looks like a mental illness because it has all of the major diagnoses and symptomology that may follow a mental illness. But when we come in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do mean in AA, not around AA, it seems like the mental illness switches to the spiritual illness, and the spiritual illness has all of the same symptoms. And God, how would you ever sort this out? That's where sponsorship comes in, willingness comes in, home groups come in, taking the steps come in, everything we throw at it, and you see if it responds. So the questions that are asked in our literature that I had suffered from, and from time to time, right up to this spot today, have certainly been a part of my life. They weren't just there when I was drinking. I have certainly struggled and come up against them in sobriety. These questions, I think, get to the point, and they're actually magnificent questions that the book brings about to us. And one is, were we having problems in personal relationships? Okay? Well, the mental illness, yes, and the spiritual illness, yes. Were we prey to misery and depression? In the mental illness, yes, and in the spiritual illness, yes. We couldn't control our emotional natures. In the mental illness, yes, and in the spiritual illness, yes. we were unhappy in the mental illness, yes, and in the spiritual illness, yes. And now you can see the correlation. What, you know, you could pull your hair out. You know, and it keeps going. Were you full of fear? Were you feeling useless? You know, you couldn't make a living, you know. And instead of calling it a diagnosis, it calls it a bedevilment. And it says that the solution to this, and I think the steps bring this about, is to take the steps and to find a higher power and to do what the steps ask us to do and see if we respond to it. That's the only way we can figure this thing out. And so I thought that, you know, from time to time that I had an emotional illness, and I didn't know until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I actually had a spiritual illness, because my spiritual illness responded to what happens here. And how it responded is my life got better. I'm a spiritually sick person. I really do believe that. And you know how when we say here, hey, some are sicker than others, and I just think, yeah, some are sicker than others, not me. Let me tell you what, I qualify today for some are sicker than others, all right? The longer you stay sober, the more aware I become of it. So, by 1978, I was looking to fit in. And I wasn't sure where I fit. I was doing a lot of things and drinking an awful lot, and I really liked Cheech and Chong Up in Smoke. I responded to that, okay? I mean, I even watched that on YouTube a couple months ago. I still respond to that. And in society at that time, you kind of had some different things going on where you could fit in, if some of you can recall it and go back to the 1978 or maybe a little bit before, a little bit after, is we had the disco. And the discotheque with the moving ball that shined the lights on the dance floor, and everybody had tight clothes on and chains around their neck. And unfortunately, I was destined to be a hippie. And so when I kind of came in the discotheque, I just didn't quite look like I fit in, okay, to the John Travolta crowd of the Saturday Night Fever. I just didn't quite have the chains or the tight clothes. I had, well, I found later on that I fit very nice in the Grateful Dead crowd, that I had my tie-dyed shirt and the loose jeans and the holes and didn't have to wear shoes or wear shoes. You could be dirty and not wash and, you know, all sorts of things. You could talk and babble, tongues, whatever, and you just kind of fit in. But before I got to the Grateful Dead crowd, I saw the punks. And the punk rockers were up in Georgetown in D.C. You may not recall this, right there on Wisconsin Avenue when you take a left right on Main Street there. And they had lots of tattoos, and they had a lot of leather. A lot of them had painted mohawks. And I would look at them, and I'd go by, and I would think, but they were angry. They called themselves anarchists, okay? And they were mean. Now, a lot of it I could have bought, and I could have dressed myself up, but I couldn't buy the real angry, mean part, okay? So I kind of fit in with the Jerry Garcia, let's get high, hey, this is cool, Cheech and Chong, wow. Unfortunately, my father was career Air Force. He didn't think that was very funny. We had a hard time in our communication. It was very difficult. And, of course, if you're an alcoholic of my type, it was all his fault because he didn't understand me. And I took that kind of attitude into a lot of places, and it never did me any good, but I always kept it. I still have that attitude sometimes today. It hasn't totally gone away. And so I was just rocking and rolling and having a hard time keeping jobs and being fired and all sorts of stuff that comes along with it. And finally, I got a job and I put some years together with it. And I almost drank myself out of that job. And I got to tell you, this is not even on the top 10 of the things that I did, but somehow it got my attention. It sent me into Alcoholics Anonymous, and here I discovered really how sick I really was. I didn't discover I was in the bottom till I started coming to meetings. My bottom didn't happen out there. It should have, because I certainly was in it. But once I started coming to meetings, I became very aware of the bottom I had been sitting in. You guys helped that. You exposed that to me. Now, I'm not saying my life is going well in any means. I'm not saying that. But I would have never been aware in 1,000 years that I was in the bottom until I started coming to meetings. And as you described your stories and where you had come from, I started to realize that I was not in good shape. You know, and the kind of thing that put the icing on the cake, I remember telling myself this early on because I'd been around people that drank in the morning and bragged about it. I said, if I ever become a morning drinker, I know I'm an alcoholic. And I became a morning drinker, and I knew I was alcoholic. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started sitting with you folks and trying to absorb a little bit by little bit about what you were saying. And the only thing I really absorbed more than anything wasn't any saying in meetings or anything you guys were kind of babbling about. I absorbed hope. There was something about your lives, and in that hope that really, I guess, united me with you, and not even knowing it, was that you guys spoke in a language, at least it seemed to me, where my life was in that unmanageable spot, you talked about stability. And that was something that had eluded me most of my life, is that from the jails and the lost jobs and the broken finances and the really no relationships much at all, you know, the house in the turmoil and everything, the stability of life evaded me. And it was always kind of like from one chaotic problem to the next chaotic problem with maybe some breathers in between, but more chaos. And it was a very unmanageable life, very unstable life. And as you guys were talking in these meetings and you're talking about your lives, I was like, yeah, I want some stability. I didn't know that that was, that my life was unmanageable yet. That kind of came to me at a later date, but the stability is what I... yes, I want that. And I became willing to do what you folks were doing, you know. I mean, I thought all of you were doing it. I didn't know any better. I was brand new. And I bumped into some people that were taking the steps, and I believe that's our medicine. And I had an awful lot of amends to make, you know, and I had a lot of financial amends to make. I had no intention of ever paying back money that I borrowed from anybody, to tell you the truth. You know, if you lent me money, you were going to be out of it, too. I mean, that's just the bottom line. And one of the ladies across the street from my mother's house, she was old and angry at me. And I had probably ripped her off for about, from what I recall, and you're talking years and years ago through lots of brain cells missing, about $10,000. She tried to pay for my last 2 years of college. She gave me the cash because I blew the college tuition up my nose and in the bar at night. And so she kind of bailed me out with loans, and it was about $10,000, and I never had any notion of ever paying her back. And then I got sober. If I had only known, you know. I might have started the payment plan earlier. You know, I had stolen an awful lot from my parents. They were no longer talking to me. I had a lot of debt sitting in front of me. About, from what I recall, it seemed to me about $28,000 of bad debt. So I started paying people back. I wrote them letters. I put $50 in a check or $25. I wasn't making a lot of money, just what I could make. I was sending it to them. And really sending the check did two things. It got them off my back, and it reduced the fear in me, because I didn't have the fear of the creditor anymore. It didn't matter how much I was sending. It was the fact that I was sending something. And I was doing a lot of this, believe it or not, not to become a spiritual person. I was really scared of drinking again. And what people were saying in AA, what I heard you, I didn't hear about the fantastic life from the steps yet. I heard that you take the steps so you don't drink again. And I was really scared of drinking again because I didn't want to go back to that. And so I did it. And I wrote those checks. And I was about 4.5 years sober, and I asked somebody that was very, very wealthy man. This man had lots and lots of money. He could never spend it in a lifetime. He drove a truck with bumps in it, and he had a winter jacket he wore for years, and when he got holes, he put duct tape on it. Great duct tape. Okay? And millions of dollars. And so I walked up to him one day and I said, look, I am not a good financial guy. I said, could you take over my finances? I'd known him pretty well. And could you help me out? I've got all these amends. I'm having a hard time paying the rents, all this kind of stuff. He said, yeah, you surrender everything to me, I'll help you. So I gave him everything. And he gave me allowance every month, which was about $100. And he said, you can live off. Thank God gas prices were about 98 cents. You know, and back then when I smoked, I think cigarettes were about $75. And he really helped me out a lot. And we got those amends. I think, again, I'm going to say it, when I was 10 years sober, my boss came to me, says, how much do you owe on those amends? And I said, I think about $7,000 or $8,000. And he said, let's go up to the bank. And he knew the guy that put the duct tape on. And he went in the bank, and he was another guy that had lots and lots and lots of money from real estate. He walked in the bank. He called the president over. You can tell that. President came on over. He said, put $8,000 in his checking account. We're going to pay all his debts off today. And he turned to me and said, are you good for it? I said, yes, sir. And he said, okay. And they did it. And I took that and I wrote all the amends, and it took me a couple years to pay him back. When I was 13 years sober, I was free of debt for the first time in my life, and have tried to stay pretty close to that right up to now, except for a mortgage. I have never got myself, I own everything. I don't have any debt coming out. I saved better. I did everything. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was a relief for me, because I was a guy that always carried that. And it was really nice not to have that anymore. And hopefully it'll keep going that way, huh? You never know with life sometimes. Well, there's another thing that starts to happen in recovery, and I don't know if it's happened to you yet. We talk a lot in the rooms from time to time about character defects, okay? I mean, that's kind of, everybody in AA, if you bring up that topic, it's kind of like saying the word God. They all kind of, oh yeah, character defects. And what happens is you start to see them in your life, and they started to come out in my personal relationships and my reaction. They were almost my default in my reactions to situations that caused stress or pressure or made me unhappy. Knowing better hasn't done the trick for me, okay? Has not done the trick. The intellectual knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous hasn't done the trick. I'm glad that I have it. I'm glad I have the knowledge. But it hasn't done the whole trick for me. Being in these situations, and I went to a meeting on Saturday that was about adversity and controversy. I thought that's an unusual but a very common subject, should be in Alcoholics Anonymous. We should probably talk about it every week. You know, I hardly ever hear those subjects. And they were reading as Bill sees it, and came up with a lot of really beneficial stuff. And one thing Bill said, that all of our successes seem to be built on our failures first. I was like, yeah, that's the story of my sobriety, you know. And these defects of character, for me, started becoming my default position. And they were very active. And they were starting to show up all over the place. And I was becoming very familiar with the terminology that we use here is resentment, all right? And I'm in a business partnership, and it's going really well for a while, and then all of a sudden it starts to sour. And the decisions that are being made are really starting to make me angry. And then all of a sudden, I'm in this real estate partnership with my brother. It's another partnership. And we own these things together that were left to us. And his decisions are really starting to make me angry. All right. And what I start finding out in all aspects of my life, things are really starting to make me angry. I'm starting to get resentful. I thought the actor of the third step was dead. Let me tell you what. That guy is very much alive from time to time in our lives. If you think you took the steps once and killed him, you're dead wrong. And it took me a while to come to this. And you know, you think about Rule 62. Don't take yourself too darn seriously. The only thing I have to remember is there's 61 rules before I get there. And the rules in my life I create, and some of the rules that I create are all absorbed in my rigidity and lack of flexibility. And if one thing has gotten me more than anything else, it's the rigidity in me trying to get my way, and it backfires almost every time. And I will do it again. Until I start getting worn down from it. And I start to see that selfishness and self-centeredness, that seems to be the root of our troubles. It doesn't go away overnight either. I just have become more aware of that own self-centeredness that comes in the personal relationships. And the 10th and 11th step are really powerhouses on this problem. When I can apply them. And like my first sponsor often said, having it in your head and put it in action are two different ideas entirely. It's a little bit more challenging to put it into action. Especially the idea of coming into these relationships where you're sore or you're hurt. Or you're offended, or you're burned up, and being able to sit down with them and be able to say, I'm wrong. And mean it. It seems to start to dissolve that conflict. And I would like to tell you that I've grown past a lot of that stuff, but I seem to get stuck in it from time to time. I'm a guy that, in AA, my default position that has saved my bacon more than not is going to meetings. I'm a guy that has always stayed faithful in the meetings. I haven't been faithful in everything else, of course, and certainly have fallen short of the principles that I do believe in. But I have always gone to a lot of meetings. And in that, it seems like AA catches back up with me, you know. Is that there's something that happens in the meetings that doesn't happen when I don't go to the meetings. I believe that my God designed it that way. That there's something special that happens when you and I meet with each other, whatever the topic is, because it really seems to me it's all the same subject anyhow. You know, you can certainly come up with what seems to be a different problem, but it's also a very similar problem. And it seems to me that you can certainly throw out a solution, but if the AA meeting as it works through, the solution seems to be very much the same. So a lot of times we think that we're bringing a unique problem to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting when we're really bringing the same subject matter to the people that live in the same subject matter. That's why we don't get confused. You know, you can say, hey, I came in here and I was resentful and the topic all of a sudden is acceptance. And you're like, oh, where'd that come from, you know? Come to a meeting and you're all caught up and something's going on and all of a sudden the topic is honesty. Or you got all these problems and challenges that are going on in your life, you go to the meeting and it's adversity. And you're like, wow, this thing is truly a miracle. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous truly is a miracle. So I've stayed pretty close to you folks. I don't want to get too far from you. I get too far off, I get in my head. And as I, you know, and I'm a guy that likes to write inventory occasionally. And what comes out in every inventory, it seems to me, is that I have a perception disorder of what's really going on in my life. And the one thing I believe that most alcoholics have, and I'm going to say most, maybe some of you don't have this, okay, but I certainly have got a mega dose of it. If you don't have any of it, I'll give you a little bit of it. And I've become more aware of it in my later sobriety than I ever was in earlier sobriety, is that's hypersensitivity. You know? I think it comes with the alcoholic, is the hypersensitivity. And if you got the character defect or you got the resentment or you got the fear, there's a hypersensitivity that comes with that that skews it and always makes it worse than what it really is. And that's why we need each other and we need a sponsor and we need the friendships to kind of, hey, you know, this is what's going on in my life. Oh, yeah, me too. I got you here. And all of a sudden, you know, after the conversation, all of a sudden I have a little bit more in perspective. And I need my life in perspective because it can get, it's almost like a typewriter. It can go left, it can go right, and then I need you folks and the sponsor and the steps and everything to throw at it to bring the typewriter back center. The only problem with the typewriter in my life, which is my thinking and my perception, it doesn't stay in the center. I wish it would. I really do. But it doesn't stay in the center. That's why I need Alcoholics Anonymous more today than maybe I needed when I was brand new. Now, having said all of that about the skewed thinking process and the perception disorder, I believe underneath that, all of us still suffer from the same thing. And the subject matter really all comes back, and we have these conversations because of one thing. It's because we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. Every conversation that I have in Alcoholics Anonymous, or every conversation that you may have, or every topic that comes up in the meeting, is because we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanageable. That's why we're having the conversation. That's the deadly earnestness over all this other stuff. See, when I think about some challenges that I have in my life today and some problems in some areas, I also have to think that when I was drinking, I didn't have those areas. You know, those areas were given to me because of Alcoholics Anonymous. In AA, what we say is we have high-quality problems today because they're sober problems. You know, I don't have the, am I going to have the DUI charge, or am I going to have the money to pay for the lawyer, or I hope I don't get the public defender, or whatever it may be, you know, the amount of money I owe. I don't have those problems today. I have sober problems. That doesn't mean that they don't get to me. Okay, they do sometimes. And sometimes they get the best of me till I get it back in perspective and find out, you know what, in the grand scheme of things, does it really matter? Well, sometimes I would tell you yes, and sometimes I would tell you no, depending on the day. The interesting thing is, about 5 years ago, and I thought all of my life I was never designed to have a child. All right, that was the last thing. If you'd asked me, that was the last thing on the list. All right, because I had worked with kids most of my life, and I loved the kids, but the child in my own house was a different idea. Of course, everybody around me was a little doubtful of my thinking. I had a lot of encouragement to have the child. And I was like, well, I'm 48 years old, you know, whatever. And so we had the child, believe it or not. And it's a whole different ballgame, you know. Sometimes I wonder, how could I have possibly done that? But most of the time I say, this is fantastic. And that's kind of been the rhyme and reason of my sobriety, if you will, is that I look at something in that way. I don't know what it is about me and negativity. I have a tendency to see the negative aspect of it rather than the positive until I experience it. And then when I experience it, I seem to have more of the positive aspect. But there's something about me that there's always that little negativity sitting in there. That's why I need to stay in here. I need to take the steps. I need to have the sponsor. I need the whole kitchen sink thrown at it. I might be finishing a little bit early tonight, but I'll finish with this idea. Is that God could have given this message. Before I start that, I will tell you something that I found very interesting. I got into the history for a while in AA, and I studied it for years and found it just, for me, it was just, I just really enjoyed it. But I found out early on in the speaker meeting, believe it or not, that the speaker was suggested only to speak for 20 minutes because that's all the alcoholic could hear. So now we speak 55 minutes, so you know how many minutes we miss. You know, I thought that was interesting. They were 20-minute talks, and now we've expanded it to 55 minutes. And most of the time I do 55 minutes, but tonight I'm for whatever reason. So God could have given this message to our friends in the medical department. And he certainly allowed them to help us. If you look at the doctor's opinion, it's worth its while. But he didn't give it to them. He could have given this message to our folks and our friends in the psychological department, but he didn't. But he allowed them to help us. And he could have given this message to our friends in the clergy, but he didn't, but he allowed us to plagiarize it. And bring it into an alcoholic language so we could all understand it. And maybe even be able to get it some, you know. I got to remember that I believed in God prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, but I couldn't get out of the county jail. And when I got here, you told me belief wasn't enough. It would have to be followed by action. And that made a lot of difference to me because I had believed in God almost all of my life. I just couldn't stop drinking. God gave this message to a broke-down stock speculator named Bill W. and a washed-up proctologist in Akron named Dr. Bob. What they had in common was alcoholism. And what they ironed out through their experience was that the ideas of Alcoholics Anonymous that are simple for me is that I suffer from an obsession that I can stop drinking any place, anytime, anywhere on my own through my own self-will or my own self-knowledge, but I can't stay stopped. I drink again. And the difference between a problem drinker and an alcoholic is very easy to understand, I think. A problem drinker, if alcohol causes problems in your life, stop drinking on your own, through your knowledge and through your willpower. I have seen them. I'm sure some of you have seen them. They just buckled up and they quit. My father was one of them. So if you're a problem drinking and it causes problems, stop. You don't need all this. But if you can't stay stopped, we have a place for you. Okay? And once I start drinking, I can't moderate my intake for some reason. Like this water tonight, I can moderate it. Alcohol, the Heineken beer, I could not moderate. Once I start drinking, I get drunk, and then I graduate into oblivion drinking. Okay? That's what happens to me. Now, besides the obsession and physical allergy theory that kind of Dr. Bob, Silkworth, Bill Wilson kind of, that was kind of their masterpiece, if you will, to the alcoholism, I suffer from something that's called a spiritual malady. Now, the spiritual malady, as I talked before, and I'm not going to go at length again, looks just like a mental malady, but it's not. They came up with the idea that I suffer from a spiritual malady. And they said that if I have an obsession to alcohol, that I can stop drinking, can stay stopped, and once I start drinking, I cannot control how much I drink, then I suffer from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. If you don't believe me, read page 44. I just stole it out of there. I read it so many times I actually memorized it. If you think I memorize a lot, you're wrong. I forget more than I memorize. And the other thing it said that I thought was very interesting, and we read it almost most meetings that we go to, that many of us suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but do recover if we have the capacity to be honest. Okay? And there's from times to times, I thought I suffered from grave emotional mental disorders, but if I have the capacity to be honest, I don't only have the obsession removed from drinking, I also have a pretty quality life today despite problems in it. The one thing that I have to remember, and they wrote all this down in a book, this is our owner's manual, to recovery, so they wouldn't forget it, and so we wouldn't forget it. And really, the outline of the program, the meat and potatoes, and there's a lot of meat and potatoes in there, is really in the doctor's opinion in the first seven chapters, which gives you the directions of the steps of how to recover from this illness. My biggest challenge in sobriety at my length of time here is not getting distracted from you by the success that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me or the problems that may occur in my life. I have watched an awful lot of well-meaning people that I have really liked, not sitting here, not that they would be here tonight anyhow, but they're not sitting with us anymore. For some reason, they got distracted. I just had a guy come back. I never knew he left. I never knew him. He came to our Monday night group, and I saw him. I went over. I greet everybody in the group, and I said, "Hi, how are you?" And he said, "Good." He said, "My name's so-and-so." And I said, "Are you new here?" He said, "No, I've been sober 27 years. I said, "Excellent." I said, "Do you live here in this hometown here?" And he said, "Yeah, I've lived here quite a number of years." I said, "I haven't seen you in meetings." He said, "I haven't gone to meetings in many years." And I said, "Well, how are you doing?" He said, "Not good." I said, "Did you drink again?" He said, "No." And if you looked at his face, he didn't look like he was doing too good. I said, "Well, I hope you can come back here." I have to remember that I have alcoholism, not alcoholism. All right. It's very present in my life today, though the drink is not there, but it's there. And that I have to make sure for me. And I just talked to a guy that I sponsor the other day, and he told me he was losing interest here, and that AA wasn't exciting anymore, and he came up with all this stuff. I said, "Well, what you have to do is, long as it's not exciting to you, you still need to go to a lot of meetings, and you still need to do these things so you can get past that so you don't leave us." Because all of us have gone from time to time in spurts of, and what I always have to remember is, am I coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to give something, or am I coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to get something? If I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to show up early, to help you out, to reach out, to see how your life is going, I'm coming to give something. In coming to give something, I actually get something. But if I'm coming to get something, a lot of times I'm going to start running on empty. We have a popular saying here that I think is dangerous. It's just my opinion. It doesn't have to be yours. Take what you want and leave the rest. If that happens, I will leave with the rest because I will take what I want. It may not be the thing I need. So with that, I want to thank you and for having me this evening. I'm going to come up here for a few minutes and give Billy his chip, his 15th year. And just think it all starts now, Billy. Thank you.